Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. Tonight on the program, we travel to the Arctic Circle and learn what being cold is all about when we visit the Ice Hotel. Also, we hear about what could possibly be the longest literary palindrome. And singer-songwriter Robin Raglan joins us in the studio for a conversation and a few songs. All that tonight on Sidetrack. Now, typically, the Midwest is known for its brutal winters, but that's nothing compared to the cold they get in the Arctic Circle. In that part of the world, the cold becomes a way of life, a way of thought, a spirituality of sorts. Recently, AM580 commentator Bill Hammack, along with his wife Amy, ventured to the Arctic Circle to visit what can be considered a physical expression of the symbiotic relationship between man and the frozen elements, the Ice Hotel.
I began to worry as the plane landed. I became alarmed when the flight attendant prepared by putting on a coat, a large scarf, and gloves. I'd hoped for a few more minutes of warmth. I was landing in the Arctic Circle in northern Sweden. I was to stay in one of the most incredible structures in the world, a hotel made completely from ice. My wife had picked up the New York Times travel section a year ago and read about this ice hotel. She learned how every year they build a 60-room hotel from 3,000 tons of snow and ice. She decided then and there that she had to visit it. Earlier that day at breakfast in Stockholm, I asked her why exactly we were going to the ice hotel. She got as close as she ever does to philosophical, for she is first and foremost a woman of action.
I want to taste everything. I want to try it. I want to sample. I want to do this really neat thing. And I've never been to Sweden, and it's a great excuse to come to Sweden and hang out in the Arctic Circle. And I've experienced the Arctic Circle in summer, but never in winter. I wanted to try out 30 below and see what that was like.
What specifically, I ask, excited her about the experience of the ice hotel?
Because it's cool, because it's beautiful, because it's ephemeral, because they build it new every year and it melts back to the river, and that's just amazing. Build ice sculptures inside, and every year it's unique.
Her very physical way of experiencing the world is not mine. She travels around the world to climb rocks or backpack along a glacier, while I prefer words. Reading to me is the supreme experience. I agree completely with the Argentinian writer Borges. I think of reading a book, he wrote, as no less an experience than traveling or falling in love. I think that reading Barclay or Shaw or Emerson, these are quite as real experiences to me as seeing London. So that day, as we flew from Stockholm to the Arctic, I buried myself in a book about traveling through the Sahara Desert. I was in denial about going to the Arctic. I had only briefly formed an image of where we were going and what it would be like. It occurred when my wife and I were packing for this trip. As we laid out our things, she pointed to a set of warm clothes and said, "We should carry them on rather than check them. They're mission critical." I don't like vacations where anything in my luggage is described as mission critical.
Landing in about 10 minutes, so it's time to check that the seatbelts are fastened.
As we approached the airport, the pilot told us it was minus 29 degrees Celsius outside. That's 52 degrees Fahrenheit below freezing. As the plane neared the ground, I began to think of those mission-critical warm clothes in our carry-on luggage. On landing, I hope for a few more minutes of warmth, but there is no jetway. So we exit the plane by a set of stairs and walk across the tarmac in the frigid weather. We'd scheduled transport from the airport to the ice hotel by dog sled, but instead got a rude awakening about exactly how cold it was. We met a representative of the ice hotel who explains why our dog sled ride has been canceled.
Too cold for the dogs, not for you, but for the dogs. Because they get so much cold air inside, it's not good for.
Too cold for the dogs, but not for me. I don't like this at all. Instead of a dog sled, we take a bus to the ice hotel. As we leave the airport, my friend Alan, we are traveling with Alan and his wife Pat, points out how far north we've flown. He notes that it is high noon, but the sun sits only 5 degrees above the horizon. Next, he draws my attention to the satellite dishes along the road. They point, he notes, toward the horizon so they can reach satellites that circle the equator half a globe away. After that, we all sit quietly and study the snow-covered landscape. I find myself wondering what my stay in the ice hotel will be like. Will it be anything like the first ice palace? It was built by a Russian princess and was a monstrous joke. The cruel Russian Empress Anna, niece of Peter the Great, had built the first ice hotel in 1740 to punish a member of the Russian nobility. Prince Mikhail angered her by converting to Catholicism, so she punished him by forcing him to sit on a basket of eggs and cackle until they hatched. Not satisfied with this, she made the prince marry one of her servants, a woman described as of exceptional ugliness. She'd been nicknamed Brushinia after the empress's favorite dish of roast pork with spiced vinegar and onion sauce. Even this forced marriage wasn't enough punishment. Immediately after the ceremony, she forced the bride and groom, festooned in furs, to sit in an iron cage on top of an elephant. They led a parade of hundreds of provincial couples, Lapps, Finns, and others, all dressed in their national costumes. They marched to an ice palace. On the Neva River, she'd commissioned an architect to build a palace of ice for the couple's wedding night. In this ice palace, she had armed guards force them to stay all night in an ice bed. In spite of its cruel purpose, the palace itself was a true work of art. Built of exceptionally clear ice from the River Neva, the palace was 56 feet tall, 17 feet wide, and over 21 feet long. To build it, the architect had precisely measured with a compass and ruler each block, carefully cut them, then used a crane to set them exactly in place. Freezing water joined the blocks so smoothly that they appeared to be one single piece. A visitor said of the ice palace that it was infinitely more beautiful than if it had been constructed of the finest marble. The transparency and bluish tone of the ice gave it the look of some precious stone. Every detail in the palace showed exquisite craftsmanship. 29 ice trees adorned the building. Flora and fauna were sculpted from ice and then painted natural colors. And while most of the palace was left transparent, the pillars, doors, and window frames were painted green to simulate marble. The window panes were made from the thinnest ice possible. So as our bus tooled along a snow-covered Arctic highway, I prepared for an experience of beauty and discomfort. Our bus arrives at the ice hotel, but we cannot see it. We must wait for a tour, plus we need to get outfitted to battle the cold weather. As we leave the bus to dash into the warm reception hall, my friend Alan draws our attention.
There's a thermometer hanging here in Celsius, reading minus 25 and a half.
Again, minus 25 and a half Celsius is some 46 degrees Fahrenheit below freezing. I'm not pleased to learn this, but I've brought with me high-tech clothes especially designed for cold weather. Most of them were an engagement gift years ago from my wife, which I now realize should have been my first clue that I'd end up in the Arctic. They're made from synthetic material that wicks water away from my body. In cold weather, this is crucial because the problem isn't getting warm, it's staying warm. As your body heats itself, it sweats. And if you wear cotton or wool, the water produced stays near your skin and pulls out the heat. So at the ice hotel reception area, I put on no less than 6 layers of clothing, then cover it with a huge insulated coverall suit supplied by the ice hotel. I put earmuffs on, then a hat, then I cover this with what I used to call a face mask, but my wife says I must now call a balaclava. Apparently, the first people to wear full face masks were the soldiers of the Crimean village of Balaclava. They popularized this headgear in ferocious battles of the Crimean War. Still, in some subconscious denial about the Arctic, I keep calling it a baklava, a food I note from Greece, a very warm country. When we finish suiting up, it's time for our ice hotel orientation tour. It begins with an ominous warning.
We have this check-in tour because this is not a normal hotel. And to be able to survive the night and enjoy your stay here, we have to teach you how to live here. And tonight it's very cold, it's minus 30 degrees, and it's actually a bit dangerously cold, so you have to beware.
With that, we are allowed to enter the ice hotel. in our 7 layers of clothing, and with the temperature dropping now to nearly 72 degrees below freezing, we thread our way along a path lined by giant ice obelisks, each 8 feet tall and 3 feet square. As my wife notes, they're the same shape and size as a porta potty. We can see the ice hotel in front of us. It's a 1-story building nearly 100 feet wide. On this trail, we pass a refrigerated Thermo King truck. It is unloading into the ice hotel skids of Absolut vodka, citron, lemon, and currant flavored. I take this as a positive sign of civilization until I realize that the Thermo King truck is needed to keep the vodka from freezing. Ever enthusiastic, Alan is, of course, at the door first.
The front entrance is built of clear blocks of ice with reindeer skin doors.
Alan, Pat, my wife, and I take a breath, and then Alan pulls on the reindeer antler door handles and we enter the ice hotel. The first thing we sense is warmth. The temperature inside the ice hotel is 20 degrees below freezing, but compared to the outside, this feels toasty. Then we notice quiet. Inside the ice hotel, all sound dies in the 3 feet thick snow and ice walls. The only sound is our own footsteps. We enter the great hallway. A mist rises from its floor. Its roof made of great arches 30 feet tall, held up by massive pillars carved from sparkling clear ice. I feel a sense of contradiction. The walls are made of snow and ice, so they seem fragile, yet at the same time massive. The supports are transparent, yet solid. There are no vertical walls. Everything is part of an arch. This drives my eye to focus on the top, where an arch culminates in a point. This point tells me that these aren't the semicircular arches of Roman or Byzantine architecture, but influenced by Gothic design. The arches look like they've been transplanted from a giant cathedral and then frosted with translucent snow and ice. Next, we set out to search for our rooms. From the great hallway, we venture down a smaller corridor, perhaps 15 feet tall, made of arches shaped like those of the great hallway. The guest rooms line this corridor. The doors of the rooms are just holes cut into the ice walls, then covered with a flimsy curtain. Next to these doors, the room number is carved in snow. We locate our rooms and enter them.
Oh, look at the chocolates, frozen solid.
The carpet is made of snow.
I've never had a bed that was lit from underneath before. This is going to be...
Are those candles under?
I don't know. Let's see.
It's a fluorescent light.
So instead of legs for the bed, there's blocks of ice, and then it looks like a wood frame.
What is it?
Oh. Foam mattress, and then reindeer skins.
Alan sums it up the best.
I see a block of ice. I see reindeer skins on it. There are no reindeer pillows. And there's a nightstand made of ice to put my glasses on so that they stick to my face when I wake up.
From there, we explore the rest of the ice hotel. We find intricate sculptures carved out of ice. In one room, a Viking ship juts out of the wall. In another, an Egyptian pyramid rules the floor. And oddly, in a corner, there's a life-size statue of Frank Zappa sitting on a toilet. Next, we come across the room, which to me is the crowning glory of the ice hotel, the Absolut Vodka Bar. To enter the bar, we pass through a 30-foot-tall ice wall where they've cut an opening the shape of a vodka bottle. The room is like a huge igloo, its dome reaching 50 feet in the air. The room is filled with tables and benches carved from 4-inch thick ice. The bar itself is one huge chunk of ice. I immediately order a drink called a Northern Light. Alan orders a fire and ice. Ironically, his breath condenses as he says fire. Our drinks are served on the rocks in the most literal sense. Our glasses are a chunk of ice with a hole in it. Our bartender explains.
We have a special drill. A machine that makes them. You drill a hole, you cut them in squares, you dip them quickly in hot water and let them freeze again. And while you dip them in hot water, it's just that you have to get the sawdust out of the bottle of the...
Following our drinks in the ice bar, we tour the hotel studying the sculptures until it's time to spend the night in the ice hotel. Staying in the hotel is much less exciting than you'd think. First, attached to the ice hotel was a real heated building. It contained a changing room and heated toilets, non-ice toilets, I note. Second, they gave us special sleeping bags rated for 20 degrees cooler than the actual temperature of the ice hotel. Our guide told us that wearing anything more than the lightest of clothes would make us sweat, and that sweat would suck the warmth from our bodies, making us very cold at night. So we change into light clothing in the heated changing room, then dash to our beds to crawl into our sleeping bags. None of us emerge from our warm cocoons until morning, when an ice hotel hostess comes by to offer us warm lingonberry juice. We then gather in the changing room, where I chat with other guests about how well they spent the night.
Very well. Woke up once, I think. I was out like a light.
Terrible, really. Main problem was the sleeping bag. Kept getting tied in knots. And they're twisting and turning all night, and you've got to untangle yourself. But other than that, I weren't cold or nothing. It was quite fine. But
although he did have one problem.
Dropped my pillow, and it went onto the floor, and I picked it up, and it was freezing. Freezing.
Next, I check with Alan and Pat.
Going to the bathroom scared me back to sleep. Just the idea of having to put on all those clothes.
My nose got cold at one point, and that woke me up, so it took a little while to convince myself I really wanted to stay inside the sleeping bag and not go anywhere.
There was the time that I was lying there, and I gave a great big exhale lying on my back, and it snowed back on top of me.
And my wife rated the experience highly.
It was great. I got up once, braved the elements to go to the bathroom, came back, which is, it's actually better than being camping, because you know, when you get out of your nice, toasty, warm sleeping bag, you don't have to go into the cold and dark and dig a hole. You can go to a nice, proper restroom with heating and lights and radio, and much, much easier than being camping.
You can see one of the problems my wife and I have in choosing where to travel. I never rate the comfort of a hotel by how far it is above digging a hole for going to the bathroom. I was eager after my night in the hotel to find out why anyone would build such a beautiful yet ephemeral thing. So the next morning, I sought out the architect of the ice hotel, a man named Oki Lawson. When we meet, I first notice Lawson's hat. It's a knit skullcap that makes him look like a medieval deacon. I expect when I glance down to see him wearing vestments, but he wears only a thin cloth jacket. He chain smokes as we chat in his barely heated office, which is scattered with papers and drawings. How, I ask, did he get started working with ice?
I've been working with wood 20 years before I turned over to ice. I started with furniture when I needed furniture. I didn't want to buy what was out in the shops. So I started with to make my own furniture. And then it turns over to be more and more artistic furniture. And suddenly I realized that there were no furniture anymore. It was just art.
Once he realized he was making art, Lawson sought out other media. He made sculptures of ice and fell in love with the medium. Over time, he refined his methods for building ice sculptures and then moved on to bigger things. I asked him what exactly the magnificent translucent arches of the ice hotel were made from.
I call these materials snice. The density is just between snow and ice.
He explains that to make the arches, they use snow cannons to blast this special snice mixture into a mold. This compacts the snow tightly so that when the temperature reaches 50 degrees below freezing, the snice becomes a mass so solid that Lawson tells me you could drive a car on the roof. Yet these arches that make up the ice hotel aren't permanent like his wood furniture. In fact, they don't even keep their shape over the season.
One of the things with the snow construction is it compresses all the time. The whole building shrinks. The building is 5.5 meter high, the highest arch. In the end of the season, it's 4.5, so it goes down 1 meter.
What inspires him to create these transient arches made of snice instead of something permanent and enduring?
Yes, I spent the summers around Europe to look at old cathedrals.
And which cathedrals inspire him the most?
In Reims, in France. Very beautiful arches. And also St. Peter's in Rome. St. Peter's for the size.
Again, I ask him why ice? Why not stone or wood?
It's to realize a dream, a fairy tale, to build a castle in snow and ice. That's the goal for me, to build up a dream. It's just for the moment. Enjoy the moment, the day you are in. Don't think about the future or the last. Just here and now, and enjoy it.
And what does he dream of building in ice, of building for the moment?
St. Peter's. And it's possible to do. The sky is the limit here.
How does he feel about his ice cathedral disappearing at the end of every winter?
Happy, because then I start to draw a new one.
Still, I wondered why anyone would create something so intricate and beautiful yet short-lived. I returned to the ice hotel to search for the answer. I found an artist working on a huge ice statue of a woman.
A lady of the river. Yeah, it's a very big lady. The mother of the river.
The statue is very detailed and has obviously taken days to carve, yet it will be gone in a few months. So I ask, why does he like working in ice?
Yeah, it's perfect. Nobody can buy it. The water takes your life back, and it's perfect for me.
I realize now that the Ice Hotel reminds us of how we should approach art and even life. The novelist Walker Percy captured the essence of this approach with a single question about the Grand Canyon. He asked, is it really possible today to experience the Grand Canyon? It seems an odd, almost nonsensical question, but Percy was after something very deep when he talked of experience. When the first Spanish explorer stumbled unexpectedly on the Grand Canyon, he experienced wonder and delight as he took in its depths, patterns, colors, and shadows. Today, our experience starts with a travel brochure and a distinct image of the Grand Canyon. When we arrive, we ask ourselves, does it look like a postcard? If so, we go home and say it's every bit as beautiful as a postcard. If it doesn't conform to our expectations, maybe the colors are somber or the day is cloudy, any disparity between the experience and the postcard makes us return home saying, I was unlucky. I wasn't there at the right time. Percy argues that the only way to truly experience the Grand Canyon is to stumble upon it. That's what, in a sense, the Ice Hotel does. It makes us stumble on it because every year it's new. It reminds us that when we approach any creative work, a piece of art, literature, a building, or even the most ordinary everyday object, to truly appreciate it, we must remove our blinders and see it fresh, unmediated by any preconceptions.
The story of the Ice Hotel was written and produced by Bill Hammack with help from Paul Winky.
Langolo, langolo.
You're listening to Sidetrack. On February 20th at 8.02 p.m., an amazing thing happened. If you take the time of day and write it out using military time, you get 20.02. Then write out the day and month using the more European way and you get 20.02. Then add the year, 2002, and you have a perfect palindrome, something that reads the same backwards and forwards. 2002, 2002, 2002. To commemorate this event, writer William Gillespie, along with Nick Montfort, decided to create 2002, a palindrome story in 2002 words. Here's Gillespie in this audio montage, reading parts of and talking about his palindrome.
2002 demands lore. Aside Roman era I, non-idle, gorilla muse we call Rig. Yo, brag us an ode tale. O readers, meet Bob. Elapse year, be glass. A palindrome is a very old poetic form in which the sequence of letters and numbers is the same forwards and backwards. Popular examples include a man, a plan, a canal, Panama, Satan, oscillate my metallic sonatas, and Mr. Owl ate my metal worm. I am interested in formal constraints, what you might call constraint-driven literature. The idea of writing a novel without the letter E, for example. So this naturally drew me to the palindrome form, which is perhaps the most difficult, popularly known, formally constraint-driven poetic form. I discovered that if you take a palindrome with an even number of letters so that there is no middle letter, you can break it neatly into a first half and second half, and you put the first half on one side of a 3x5 card and the second half on the other side of a 3x5 card, you can write as many of these as you like, shuffle the 3x5 cards, put them in any order, and if you read through the stack from the top card down to the bottom, flip it over and read through it backwards, the result is always a palindrome. So to put that more simply, we started by writing little palindrome fragments, and we started with a pile of those. We arranged them into a single text file, and then we passed the text file back and forth, taking turns, arranging it, polishing it, adding new fragments. The whole time we used computer programs we wrote ourselves, collectively called Deep Speed, to verify that the palindrome was in fact perfect at every step so that it could be reversed. We didn't want any errors creeping into the process early on that we would then have to try to weed out later. The French mathematician Paul Brefort, on February 20th, to celebrate the palindrome day, sent out an email in French during which he claimed that Nick and I had written the longest literary palindrome in the world, longer indeed than Georges Perec's Le Grand Palindrome. I'm not sure I agree with this. First of all, we need to know what distinguishes a literary palindrome from a non-literary palindrome, but I can say for sure that there is a palindrome much longer than this called The Big One, written by Will Helston, a guy in England. In 2002, a palindrome story was first released in a limited signed edition of 202 copies that we sent out to friends and writers on New Year's Day, 2002. February 20th, that is 2002, we put the whole thing on the web. It's scheduled to come out as an illustrated book on October 1st, 10/01, 2002. Omega's sagas, Bob, fine peg, alludes. A bedlam I seed now. On, Bob, to home. Gas, Bob. Crass algebra. Eyes pale. Bob teams red. Arrow elated on a sugar. Boy, girl, lace. We sum all. Ire. ugly din. 1 year enamored is Aero LSD named 2002.
That was William Gillespie. He, along with Nick Monfort, have written 2002, a palindrome story in 2002 words.
Someday mother will die and I'll get the money. Mom leans down and says my sentiments exactly. You son of a bitch,
you've got it tuned to Sidetrack. In the studio with me now is Robin Raglan. She has a disc out, her debut disc called Modern American Female Gut. We're going to talk with her in just a moment, but first, so you can get a flavor of what she sounds like, we're going to have her perform a song. So this is Robin Raglan performing People You Know.
Found myself thinking about you today when I conjured your classic expression. Nobody noticed me wearing it, so I went on like it was mine. At some point I heard the word time slip out with a thick southern drawl like my girlfriend's. And then I watched as my hands began talking like mom, and I really started freaking out. Isn't it odd? Take you and me, we're two little ants in one giant community. But whether it's fate or proximity, we're one of my people, the people I'm into. I miss you, yeah, I feel akin to you. 'Cause it's the people you know, the people who knew you, and wherever you go, they're the ones that get to you now. They get in your head, in your dreams, in your soul. They're the people, the people, the people you know. Remember that guy at your job who got fired when he slept with the boss's ex-wife? He wound up in bed with your roommate's old girlfriend. Well, anyway, you high. Isn't it odd? Take you and me, you carry around a big chunk of my history. And I didn't know I was behind the doors till you called and the closet cracked open. Cause you could see who I was. Cause it's the people you know, the people who knew you, and wherever you go, they're the ones that get to you now. They get in your head and your dreams and your soul. They're the people, the people, the people, you know. Ooh, oh, the people, the people, the people, you know. Ooh, oh, it's the people, the people, the people, you know. I thought I'd flash back to my college days. Give his old number a call. I know we thank God we're both doing fine. It's history, money's in my mind. Oh, I've long moved away, but those days wrote a book in my life. Ooh, it's the people you know, the people who knew you, and the ones you let go, and the ones you let screw you now. They get in your bed and your dreams and your soul. They're the ones you read up on when you check out the horoscopes. The people you know, the people who love you, and the ones who you loved. They're forever a part of you now, in spite of the millions and billions you don't. It's the people, the people, the people you know.
Ah, that's great. Robin Ragland performing People You Know from her debut album, Modern American Female Gut. And it's kind of neat how the word gut goes right on your belly button.
Oh, that's true. I never had anyone really notice that. And I think it was accidental.
Oh. That song actually was out way before the album.
Well, ooh, that's a story.
Well, yeah, and that's kind of what I'm pointing towards. Because that opens up a larger issue, which I want to talk about in a bit. But why don't you tell us a story about that song and getting the whole album out?
Well, I was signed to a label at that point it was a fairly good-sized independent out of L.A. and New York called Red Ant. And went through all the normal processes, I suppose, of, you know, recording, you know, the photo session, getting the artwork sort of started, starting on the radio promo, you know, tour sort of thing. Although basically they sent a single of the song People You Know to just a handful of radio stations in the beginning, and St. Louis was one that got it first. Being my hometown, they were so excited and they started playing it and it started getting a great reaction. So pretty soon that song was just like in heavy rotation in St. Louis and hearing it all over the place. And so then, of course, you're now waiting for the record to come out. And that time extended and extended months and months. And then, sadly, the label sort of went out of business before ever putting out the record. So I was sort of at that stage, you know, going crazy. And when a label goes down, it's just a, at least in my experience, it's just a mess and nobody knows which way is up. And all I wanted to do was get my record out because it, you know, now the clamoring had begun, you know, let's have it. You know, when is it coming out? You know, radio interviews. When is it? Oh, soon, soon. It was just a nightmare. Because
you would find yourself basically in record release limbo.
Exactly. For quite some time. I mean, it might have been like, I know it was over 6 months. So finally, I just sort of on my own dime and everything just did a regional release, or actually local release, and got it into the stores and had a release party, and sort of instead of doing the full-blown, okay, here we go on national radio, it was just sort of, okay, let's backtrack and let's start at the grassroots and let's make this thing at least happen to some degree.
Well, you also had another song that's on this album, Peace on the Water, appear in an episode of Dawson's Creek.
Yeah, that was a good thing. You know, you meet various people, and I still have various like good friends out in L.A. and, you know, involved in different things. The guy who actually made that happen was one of the writers at Hits Magazine, who handed it to a friend, and then that happened, and that's kind of cool.
Well, the fact that you found yourself in record release limbo, as I said, it brings up these larger issues, sort of, you know, the one artist against a label.
The world.
Oh yeah, well, against the world. You know, because you deal with not only the music side, I mean, that's almost the easy side, but you deal with all this business side and the legal side.
Oh, yeah.
And then
it's hard.
And then on top of that, you get the issues of these small independent labels and you as an independent artist trying to go up against major labels and the money that they can throw.
Yeah, and there's really no competition whatsoever. I mean, you sort of are just in a different league and yeah, I don't know. I mean, at that point, instead of sort of looking at trying to figure out where you sit in the market, you basically just follow your own instincts. I mean, it really, you know, as the title, you know, tends to support, you know, just sort of go with what, you know, go with the pockets of hype that are happening and follow through on everything and care about everything. And, you know, it's exciting because everything's so real. Everything's on the real level and you're kind of doing it yourself. You know? So it was a great experience. I felt like I was a one woman record label.
Well, how about giving us another song?
Oh, sure.
Which one do you feel like playing?
Well, you tell me.
Well, how about since we mentioned Peace in the Water, that song, for good or bad, that appeared on Dawson's Creek. Some people will argue.
I know,
both.
I would always say, and know, you know, at live shows, I know all of you are avid watchers of Dawson's Creek. I'm going to treat you to something now you know by heart.
So why don't you play that? This is Peace in the Water from Modern American Female Gut. Robin Raglan, our guest here on Sidetrack.
Sad investigation. Cares in the winter, gonna find a summer's day. Yeah. Ooh, peace in the water, got a sad investigation. I don't know why. I don't know. There's a light in the stair, just staring through the air. There's a face in the hall, spinning up the wall. I can feel so far, only far as I'm able. But the saying won't sit, and the light's been lit. Now I'm scared what I'll find when I look behind. My God, I'm here, but my mind is stretching around me. Peace in the water, 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 yeah. Who cares what I'll find when I stare at the stars, when I look behind? What's that light? It's a scream from yonder. Well, my path's been lit and I listen to it. I can see my fires come down. I'm estranged from the little light, but I can see my fires. Ooh, peace in the water, peace in the water, peace in the water, peace in the water. Peace in the water, peace in the water, peace in the water, peace in the water. Go home to the meadow. Take it on the run. I'm gonna check my meadow. I'll find my way. Take it on the run. I'm gonna check my meadow. Whoa, whoa.
Peace in the Water, Robin Raglan, here live, playing for us, and you're listening to Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. I like that one. That's a good one. Peace in the Water. That's from your debut album, Modern American Female Gut. Well, you started your career with a college band out in L.A., cut your teeth out there, and then you came here to the Midwest.
Yep.
And became a solo artist. Is there a culture shock between the West Coast and the Midwest?
There was, but it was a very pleasing one, as it turned out for me. My family, both sides, are from St. Louis. I'm kind of from rural, like, around St. Louis. So I think that's part of the reason why I live on a farm now. It's sort of in my blood somehow. And going to the farm when I was a child, I would always come back to St. Louis, but I never really understood the Midwest as you do when you live here. In fact, growing up in California, it was, I think I'm one of the few Californians who really admit this, but it's very isolated and very in a sort of just not egotistical way, because you don't know any better, but you just think the sort of everything ends, you know, at the Rockies and here's the world, and you know the rest of the nation exists, but really, everything that you need is right there. And so you don't spend a lot of time thinking about, I don't know, the rest of the country, which just sounds horrible. And I didn't like that. I mean, I knew that I was missing something. And coming out, when I first came out to St. Louis, it was just an amazing eye-opening, like, okay, here's where, like, real life is. It's not brand new asphalt. It's like asphalt that's been here a while, and it's not a brand new glistening club that just went in last week and now everybody's hanging out and, you know, driving their new cars too. I mean, this sounds terrible, I know, because that's not really fair to California. But for me, it was just so enriching to get back to a place where it just felt like the roots were just thick.
When you were putting together your album, your debut album, what sort of inspiration, where did you find inspiration for the songs, for the style? I guess that's a larger question, too. Where do you find your musical inspiration?
Well, it's, I think, you know, the reason why I named the album Modern American Female Gut, beyond that it just came to me, and then I thought, okay, that's it, I tend to make everything an emotional experience, you know? Music and my life aren't really that separated, and neither is even what I've done in my life, like going to school and all of that. The way I do things is usually to sort of make it, like, take it in, you know, just take it all to heart. Not in a, like, I'm going to cry over it all way, but take it all to heart, and it becomes mine and my experience. And I think my music just sort of, and I don't know, I mean, in saying that, it makes me feel like that must be how everybody writes. But, I mean, that's where it comes from. It comes from, okay, I've got this idea, like, you know, people you know started as just this concept. One of those concepts that is so simple, and you try to explain it, and it becomes profound in your own mind, but then you try to explain it, and you can't quite communicate it beyond. But the song, you know, writing a song helps to get that profound point of that very simple idea across.
Do you feel up for one more song?
Oh, sure.
Okay. What do you feel like?
How about my favorite song on the record right now?
Which is
Love, 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 Love.
Okay.
Sound good?
Sounds great. Robin Raglan, Love, 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 Love from her debut disc, Modern American Female Gut.
There's no proof, no.
Robin Raglan, here in the studio, performing Love, 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 Love. That's from her debut disc, Modern American Female Gut, and she is here, and you are listening to Sidetrack. So what's next for you, Robin?
Well, I'm working on my next record.
Yeah?
And I'm very excited about it, yes. And just sort of taking the winter months to write and demo it, and then we'll see where that goes.
Any more songs appearing on various syndicated programs?
There are a few things happening out there, yeah.
No more Dawson's Creek.
No, not yet. I need the right episode to come along. And
well, why don't you tell people if they're online where they can go to find out more about
Robin
Raglan.
Oh, yes, please come and visit me. It's robinraglan.com, and it is spelled weird.
It's spelled with two N's.
Yeah, and a
Y. I typed in, with a Y. I typed in Robin with one N.
Did it work?
No, not you. I got a real estate seller.
Is her last name Raglan?
Yeah.
Wow.
So,
Soul sister. Except, real estate. That's hard.
So it's www.robynnraglan.com.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Robin Raglan, here on Sidetrack. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website. Just go to will.uiuc.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Join us again the first Wednesday in April for another edition of Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.